This is David Franco and Teresa Deetze with our 15th group session on practical work on self. And tonight we're going to continue our hopefully still lively discussion of remorse of conscience, chapter 14, and then move into doorways. Doorways are a good place to move into. So, what I'd like to start with tonight, unless David has other agenda, is to ask people if we have any discussions or considerations or insights from this week's exercise.
I'd like to reread the header, and so as to help us orient once again to this particular chapter, and to take a second for all of the audience that's listening, whether tonight or in a year or two or whatever, and that as you begin to move into this material, it's a good practice to work to shake off what I call the road dust and enter into the space that we are in. It's a high-paced society that we tend to live in, and sometimes we want to get into a different space when we work with and begin to inquire about these different types of ideas. So that moment is now. So I'm going to read the header, and then we'll take up Teresa's question, which is actually what we left with last week, and it's a good one. So I'm putting these on because I need to. So the chapter title is Remorse of Conscience. The header is, "The organ conscience is, in ordinary man, atrophied from disuse and isolation. Remorse of conscience can repair our past, no matter what we may have done." So, how did that investigation go with everybody this week? Or Teresa, I think you might have some questions.
No, just I know Leona was going to share something, but she's not here, so maybe she'll turn up after a bit. And I certainly had some I experience with it myself. But I'd certainly like to hear from everybody else and just get a sense of where we are together as a group at this point in time. Does anybody have any experiences? Oh, there, Leone. Hello, Leone.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So we're looking forward to continuing the conversation that you and I were also discussing about remorse of conscience. You had some brilliant insights, and feel free at any point in the conversation to jump in and bring that into the conversation. I'm just asking everybody what our experience was in the course of the week exploring this exercise.
Okay.
Set Diana?
I'll go. I didn't know if Leonie was going to go. For
No,
me,
I just. No, she's still tuning in. She's
Okay. That's.
catching up energetically here.
Okay. I'd say a lot of it, where I am right now, is a combination of what I learned in class last week, Teresa, what you and I have been talking about, and just what I've been working on. I have, at this point, cultivated, I would say, a theorem about what this means. I have not yet achieved this in a practical exercise, but I'm hoping at some juncture in this lifetime I will. And to you and I had a lot of dialogue about what's a saint. And we started that in class last week. And for me, I think of thinking of my mother as a saint. assuming she actually did the work and that, you know, to elevate herself, which she isn't doing right now, but if she were doing work, could I actually see her in a point of sainthood? And I sort of went down this chain of thought and thought sainthood is clarity, which is light, like being full of light or encompassed in light is the definition I came up with. So what I had a moment of sort of seeing and believing last week was this great sense of light being surrounding us, surrounding me, surrounding my mom, surrounding these beings, and believing if I can get to a point of forgiveness where my non-essential self is what I really truly believe to be true, if I can accept that lightness and that sainthood within myself, I'll be able to accept that and see that within my mother. And I do believe that that energy moves today forward, backward, and can really free generations of enslaved women, all enslaved in this sick belief of just pushing pain down from one generation to the next.
Wow.
There was a person here who had said to me some years ago that she felt that she was able to free five generations.
Yeah.
If she herself become free, herself, her mother and her grandmother, and her daughter and her grandchild. And so she saw that with a certain sense of clarity for herself.
Yeah, I've had the same experience when I was in England and Ireland last year. I sort of had a sense where I was the one who was supposed to, like, free my lineage. I couldn't give you definitions of generations, but I mean, I had a sense of that, too.
Yeah. And you have a lineage. You have a lineage, then, to be able to free. And that's part of the gift that we're given, is that that's a possible form of work that we can do. So
yeah.
That is a form of service. So it's... how do we begin to do that? And this particular chapter talks about a particular method of doing it. And the method is the exercise of practicing using something called remorse of conscience. And I'm very interested to hear if someone had a chance to take that out for a test drive this week.
Guillermo here, yeah?
Speak up, yeah.
Yes?
Go for it, Guillermo.
Yeah, thank you. Although I read the relationship with the ancestors and the liberation, I didn't take it really honestly. That's still very obscure to me. I tried to go to the practical thing that I could handle.
Yep.
And for me was an exercise in transmuting that remorse into gratitude, to using the relationship, I guess, that in general we have with our mother, and how grateful we are for whatever we have received. And in my case, the exercise transformed or became practical in expressing through my actions to as many people as I could that gratitude, in kindness, in being useful in whatever ways, and doing my actions as much as I could, bringing forward that sense of gratitude and payment.
In the chapter, Guillermo, it says at the end of page 124, it indicates, soon, not only will we respond very differently to everyone, more responsibly, but we can also, in this way, repay our debts to her. So something different happens. What's happening here? What's part of the goal? Let's parse this out a little bit. Let's break it down. What's part of the goal here? What does it say in the header?
That the organ of conscience is being dormant, and
okay,
we can bring it alive again?
Yeah.
I don't have the book.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I don't have the book with me. Sorry, I'm trying to...
Yeah, that's about right. And so the author, you know, E.J. Gold, is actually saying to us, he's indicating that there's a something called the organ of conscience, that we can actually develop this as a vital organ that we utilize. Isn't that interesting? That we would have a vital organ that currently isn't there, but suddenly becomes something that maybe is as useful to us as our lungs or our liver or our heart or our spleen and et cetera. Anyway, it's like, so what body has that thing called the organ of conscience? Right?
So is the organ, can I ask a question?
Of course.
Sure.
Yes.
Is the organ of conscience, is the organ, like, which could be a liver, could be a kidney, could be a heart, is the organ of conscience connected to guilt?
I'd like to say something about that. First of all, it's an interesting exploration. Last week, Silverdale told us that Gurdjieff had something particular in mind when he spoke about the organ of conscience that was probably too much for us to bite off and chew in this session. Perhaps we'll get into that more at some point. So I have a few insights that may fit with that, and you can, if they don't fit for you, you can bring it back to your question and ask it again. But for me, in my estimation, an organ can run a virtue, or an organ can run a negative emotion, depending on what kind of energetic we're feeding it. So, for instance, liver could be, is traditionally one of the main associations is anger, but also it could be boundaries, and it could be clarity, clarification. There are different positive as well, or positive virtues that go with an organ, or there's also relationships that are more negative emotions that are associated with those organs. That means that's where the sensations of those feelings tend to resonate with more weight through the body when we're feeling and thinking things that begin to create energetics within the body, and also that impact, that the body impacts what we feel and think, just like we're talking about with posture. So the organs will inform how we feel. If the liver's congested from toxicity, it's easier to get angry and irritated, but also anger and irritation could congest the liver. So as far as guilt goes, guilt, one would have some choice to an extent that we're in the non-phenomenal self rather than mechanical. We have a degree of choice some of the time anyway about what we're experiencing in the organs, what we're feeding the organs with, because of what we're generating at that level. So coming back to guilt, in my explorations with the chapter, there's a few insights I'll share at some point, but the main one is that guilt is mechanical and guilt is reactive. Remorse of conscience is an intentional exploration that creates possibility. So guilt is mechanical, and it just kind of happens. It's reflexive. It's part of the machine. Remorse of conscience is a way of directing our attention and our intention in an open exploration that allows us to recreate things for ourselves, which has to do with repairing the past. And at some point, I'd like to get into more about what it means to repair the past. But let's go a little farther where we are now first. Was that Mike?
No.
Was it you who wanted to say something?
So what is it? What then is, what would the exercise, if I understand you right, you said something about it's an intentional exercise?
An exercise in intention. It's applying one's attention. It's like mentation, but applying the mentation toward a specific kind of learning that opens things, opens us up to create a different possibility.
So what is
in terms of our behavior?
So what is that?
Pardon me?
And so what is that specific intention or specific exercise in relation to this particular chapter?
Well, we spoke last week about remorse being, somebody said that remorse was similar to gratitude. And in my personal explorations about that, when I was scratching away in my interior world, checking this out, it seems to me that gratitude and remorse both rely on sensing. And there's a certain experience of sensations that go through the body and the energy systems as we consider the way we impact the world and the way we're impacted by the world and the interface between ourselves and the world because of what kind of actions we're putting out. It's an experience in like dropping a stone in the world, as it were, through our actions, and then sensing inside ourselves how we feel when we do that, and perhaps considering that we might be able to make some adjustments in the way that we're interfacing with the world to bring forth more gratitude, or to use the remorse to fine-tune the way that we interact in order to create possibilities that weren't there before. So instead of being mechanical and reacting out of our unrepaired past and just doing the same crap over again, we're sensing into how we feel when we respond differently and see what happens in the world around us and how that interface between us and the world changes.
If I may say, I agree with you, Teresa. Yeah, in my case was exactly that too. I see the motive of my action is to say, well, I have to interact with the world. So I choose to interact in this world. It must be some kind of ripples that I may not see, or I may yes see it, but that is the effect. The effect is in the outside, and obviously in some way will come back to me, which I cannot perceive in what ways, but definitely there will be my action and my intention will have an impact in the outside world, and fuel, but that sense of gratitude, if you can say, of returning to the world what the world has given me, be it your mother or life or God or whatever.
Okay. Or it could be, in addition to returning, I see remorse of conscience as a creative act.
That's right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I said it as best I can when I say, well, the guilt is mechanical, has to do with recreating things out of the past, reactive. Remorse of conscience as an intentional exploration that creates possibility. You're creating possibility. We respond differently to other people, maybe differently to our mother, differently to our circumstances, because the remorse has, the focused attention in the process of the remorse just expands our sense of possibility and our sense of connection with our experience. It's like the opposite of being a victim, in a way.
It's 100% opposite. And, I mean, the exercise, it doesn't say to develop gratitude, but it talks about this idea, though I think that is an interesting key, by the way. It talks about remorse, and the idea is to feel the sense of remorse. Now, we began to create the distinction between remorse and guilt. I thought we were on a great path there. And I think, Leona, I think you asked that question.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And I maintain, as I think Teresa is indicating as well, that it most certainly is not. However, maybe the guilt is a touchy thing, certainly nothing that I would want to depend on. But we can use these first stirrings of conscience activated by the mood of remorse for past wrongdoings and injustices on our part to provide us with the motivation to conserve our precious time and energy to work on, to awaken the machine. And
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you think that the machine is awakened by guilt or by remorse?
The machine is reinforced by guilt and awakened by remorse.
Well, excuse me. The asleep machine is reinforced and kept and strengthened by guilt. The asleep machine. And then the asleep machine, it just flops around as a fish out of water, just doesn't know what to do. It is a sleep and reactive, as a machine might be, that part of us that we're calling the asleep machine.
Okay, we have some comments coming in over the internet. For pause. I missed last week, so I did not do the exercise, but thinking about having remorse for my mother makes me very emotional because I know how it will affect me. Sinhog, I think guilt is remorse unrealized. For pause.
Good. I like that.
It will change my existence for better, but I will have to be ready to let go. Can you repeat that, David?
I like what Sinhog had to say. And for some reason, the author is telling us, look at the idea about the relationship with your mother. These are just arbitrary sentences, but well thought out concepts that we can use as practical work for ourselves. So here's this idea of remorse attached to mother. Now, granted, there are times when our mother was just a screaming, crazy nut. Well, guess what? That's the mother that in that state is in her mechanical self, right? Just in her own stuff, her own possession. She's possessed. That's the mother too. And in a sense, we have two mothers, and the mother that is also the essential self that sacrificed something to help us and launch us, in a sense, off the shore into existence.
I just wanted to provide some additional background information regarding each of these words. This is Silverdale. I've stressed before that what we're studying here has its origins in Gurdjieff's foundational ideas.
Yep.
So the way that Gurdjieff would explain remorse is this way. you'll have to trust me on this, and I am simplifying a lot of information into some very simple sentences. But as I've mentioned before, the Absolute was forced to create the now existing creation in order to save himself or herself. And he did that by modifying the three forces that comprise himself or herself. And we are identical in that process if we reverse engineer it, by which I mean this. This is what Gurdjieff says. The first force develops in a boy between conception and the age of 11, at which time it stops developing altogether, and a second force begins to develop starting at the age of 9 and continuing until the age of 20. That second force stops developing at the age of 20, at which time a third force, which becomes the force of remorse, the remorse of conscience is a part of, begins at the age of 20. In a girl, these three forces develop during a different period of time. For a girl, this first force starts at the moment of conception and continues only until the age of 7. The second force begins to develop as early as the age of 4 and stops developing at the age of 13. And the third force in a woman begins at the age of 13 and continues for a period of time. So the reason this is important is that first force that begins to develop in each of us for a very specific period of time allows us to develop an awareness of ourselves in the multiplicity and diversity of the world around us, and that's a normal part of our development, and it is. The second force, which begins in a boy at the age of 9 or begins in a girl as early as the age of 4, is the development of our non-phenomenal self, which allows us to create a vibratory sensation within ourselves that senses the unity of everything existing in an undifferentiated way. And it's as intelligent and cognizant of itself, that second force is, as our first force is about the multiplicity and diversity of life. Now, these two forces become important because both of these first two forces are involuntary slaves to cosmic purposes far greater than themselves. That is, that first force we are involuntary slaves to, and when we intentionally develop our second force, our non-phenomenal self, that also is an involuntary slave to cosmic purposes. The only place that an individual, man or woman, has any real, genuine freedom is when that third force begins to develop, which requires that they intentionally blend their non-phenomenal self, that second force, with the first force. And in the blending of those two, you experience remorse of conscience. That is, you experience what the Absolute experiences in the moment after creation when he says, what the hell did I just do? I saved myself, and I created a mess of a creation that all those poor creatures within it have to deal with. And hopefully, in learning to deal with it through remorse of conscience, that is the same thing I'm experiencing, a type of suffering, they will be able to help me. They'll be able to assuage my own sorrow and my own suffering. Now, within that context, when we get to this book, Practical Work on Self, and we read about the mother, what Gurdjieff is, you have to bear in mind that this book, Practical Work on the Self, that we're reading, presumes that you've already mastered what I have just said, that you already know and fully comprehend what I have just said very simply.
Right.
And so within that context, the mother in here is not a literal interpretation of our own specific mother, although we use her maybe as a way of trying to understand this, but it doesn't refer to our physical mother. What it actually refers to, in my opinion, is the first force that we develop of multiplicity and diversity within the creation. That is our physical body, which is an involuntary slave. That is our mother who produces the child of the non-phenomenal self and our historical personality, producing that third entity, the third force, which is able to experience remorse of conscience, which is nothing more than sharing in the suffering of the Absolute, who says in the moment after creation, what the hell did I just do? I saved myself and transferred my burden to those within the creation. And I'll even back that up by saying I also have right here on the desk in front of me, I mentioned this in one of my previous notes, this practical work on self we're reading right now is an edited version of a private publication that was published by IDHHB in 1979. And so, for example, I'll just read the first paragraph of this chapter, Remorse of Conscience, in this private publication, 1979, which I think Gurdjieff himself wrote, is this. G began soon after the reading, which dealt with life on the planet Remorse of Conscience, also called Purgatory. And as I mentioned in a note before, in Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, there is a chapter, The Holy Planet Purgatory. And the Holy Planet Purgatory there defines remorse of conscience, those who are so who suffer because they can see the absolute so close and know they are still separated from. So anyway, sorry for the...
No, don't apologize. It's excellent material. Just relax and breathe a little bit while you're sharing it. It's fine if you can take this space gently. Well, you're right here anyway. Could you tell us what it means to repair our past in this context?
Yes, what happens, you know, and again, I'm now speaking from personal experience. Once you understand that once any of us understands that we are involuntary slaves to the creation, we did not ask to be conceived, we did not ask to be born in our particular circumstances, we have not asked to experience anything we want in life, and we, of course, become completely conditioned to life around us, and therefore, we can't live our lives independently from now until the last moment we draw our last breath until we actually begin to activate that second force, that is cognizance of the unity of everything existing, which should be as normal to us as a fish swimming in water or us breathing air, or in the same way we're involuntary slaves, our historical personalities are involuntary slaves to being a part of life itself. Gradually over a period of time, as we develop our non-phenomenal self, that is a vibratory sensation of the unity of everything existing in an undifferentiated state. And again, it becomes as real to us as our historical personality is real to us. Once that non-phenomenal part of ourselves strengthens and grows, it begins to help the historical personality repair its past by, in a sense, forgiving ourselves. And in that forgiving ourselves, we relax enough that we understand we're involuntary slaves. And then we begin to understand, look, the only thing I can really do is relax and enjoy life, and I can relax and not be so concerned about the past.
Forgiving ourselves for what?
I'm sorry?
Forgiving ourselves for what?
Forgiving ourselves for all the actions that we commit while we are involuntary slaves.
Okay, great.
Now,
just one thing. So the first, remember, David, the first questions I did about this teaching was, I wasn't too off the mark, because my first question was, are we talking about our mother or what? So it seems to me that it is beyond that.
That's right. And by the way, just one other point of reference here. Gurdjieff defines exactly what he means by saint. Hold on, I just have to get back to it. What Gurdjieff says is that when he was, Gurdjieff had learned that when people were, you know, in ancient times, when people were beginning the path of self-evolution and transformation, become high beings, they were divided into three categories of initiates. And the initiates belonging to the first category, that's the lowest of category, because you graduate from the first category to the second to the third. The initiates belonging to the first category were those who, thanks to their intentional sufferings and conscious labors, That is their ability to identify with the suffering of the absolute, attained a high gradation of what is called being. And for this, they acquired the title saint. So when we read in Practical Work on Self, for the mother is regarded as a saint, what he's really saying, this is not taken literally, this is, oh, I see, once that second force blends with the first force and produces the third force, which is the force of reconciliation, harmonization, neutralization, and most importantly, spiritualization of that entity, then that being acquires a definite, more or less permanent, kind of vibrational frequency of being, and that being is called a saint. And then, just to finish the paragraph, to the second category belong those who, thanks to the same factors, acquired a great deal of all kinds of information, and to their names was added the title learned. So they were not only saints, but they were learned saints. And to the third category, those who, by means of the same factors, attained being and also enlightened themselves concerning a great number of objective truths, and to their names was added to the title sage. So, you know, those are kind of the steps that are possible in this lifetime for us. But in this case, it's not literally our mother. When our historical being achieves a definite level of beingness, that historical personality of ours becomes, which is our mother. It's the womb within which the non-phenomenal part of ourselves can grow and ultimately serve as our father. And then father, son, and then the blending of that father and that mother produces a child or the Holy Spirit, which can be termed our own which is our own saint, you know. Well, let's put it this way: our mother is our historical personality is the mother, which achieves a certain degree of beingness, which is a saint. So, anyway,
that is so useful. Thank you. It actually means quite a lot to me, and it really helps me with something. In the last course, in the second half of the class, I got really quiet, and what I was chewing on it really bothered me was this feeling, well, what if you didn't ask to be conceived in the first place? And it went beyond my, you know, I wasn't wanted, but it wasn't really about that. I just had this feeling like it was bothering me, and it felt like it needed to be part of the question, and I didn't know why it needed to be part of the question, and now I see it's because it already is a part of the ideation behind it. So I had this extremely powerful experience one time, absolutely unforgettable. In my 20s, I was at a very high intensity spiritual gathering, and at some point, I just absorbed enough of the energy there that I started to kind of fracture somewhere at the ego level. And I went in the back of this friend's truck where there was this mattress for resting, and I was screaming and crying for like 2 or 3 hours. And what I was experiencing was this interface, and it seems to be what you're talking about the remorse of conscience. It's like, well, if I didn't want to be here and I'm awake, it's not like you can kill yourself, because if you did, you'd just wake up in another body anyway, and then you're still on the wheel. And so the only way out is like through, all the way into God realization, because if you there's this place one could go where, you know, one's almost a victim of God, because if you didn't want to be created, or you change your mind about that, you know, you're here and it's too late, and you can't go away from that, and there's this relentless, inexorable movement toward awareness, or, you know, one's resistance to awareness isn't going to really help or make much difference, because whether we go through upside down or backwards or straightforward or screaming or and you know, kicking and screaming, or whether we welcome it 100% and we're in gratitude, we're still in the game and we're still going through it. And so I always wondered about that particular experience and what that was and where it came from. And as you've talked about the remorse of the creator and creating the creation and these things that you've just said, it was exactly pertinent to the part of reality that I was tuning into and experiencing through all my fibers during that period.
Well, thank you, T.
For what? I feel overexposed now.
I'm glad to know I'm not alone in the world.
Oh, likewise, Silvertail. That's what I'm trying to say here.
I think we could all tell similar type stories. I mean, in a sense, everything has been happening mechanically. And we all possess a particle of divinity. It's just that particle of divinity is divided into three forces that we're ignorant of. Once we educate each of those three forces, that particle of unity becomes really a part of the absolute. And things
how
don't
do you
change.
Educate it?
We're just informed.
Leona, what are you saying?
How do you educate it?
How do you educate that part?
Well, you know, it's just like any school. For myself, I found a very good teacher, Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff explains, Gurdjieff creates a million-piece jigsaw puzzle. He says, put it together, and you'll understand everything you'll ever want to know about anything and everything. But other than that, it's just a matter of finding a teacher who says, okay, you have a historical personality that learns to juggle very well multiplicity and diversity. You know, might drop a few things periodically, but for the most part, it's good at doing that. Now, I want to talk to another part of yourself, which you're probably not familiar with, called your non-phenomenal self. This is like a vibratory sensation. It's the spirit that animates that physical body that you regard yourself to be. And so gradually, just like going to school every day, you know, you give it information and it gradually grows, and by osmosis is nourished and becomes what it is. And then you say, and by the way, now I'm going to talk to the third part of you, which is the blending of the second part of you, the non-phenomenal self, consciously and intended. It's the voluntary contact between your non-phenomenal self and your historical personality. And that third part of you, that third force within yourself, has other possibilities. So it's an educational expense in that sense. And then not only do you have to educate each of these three parts about themselves, you have to introduce them or educate them about the other two parts so that rather than – see, each of these three parts has the lawful right to refuse to submit. That's the way the Absolute set it up. Each of these three forces, like a man and a woman and the force of potential reconciliation between them, each of these three parts has the lawful right to refuse to submit. And that was necessary in order to keep tension in the universe and keep it self-sustaining. But once you've educated each of these three parts of yourself, then you teach each of them to cooperate together in mutual reciprocal passivity. And once that happens, well, then it's like a greased wheel. It just runs automatically on its own, you know.
Okay.
Over a long period of time, anyway.
At some point, so that's the matrix of how it works.
Yeah.
Then how do you create, how do you initiate that tension in such a way that the interplay between those two starts to work? What's the individual mechanism that someone can avail themselves of whereby that planet purgatory becomes an actual space that the person is in that, and seeing the absolute ahead and being in that place of yearning for that and that being in that interplay between the two. And thereby we have, this is not a book of philosophy. This is a book of pragmatic work on self. What keys and tools and levers do we have to initiate our own self in that process? And what is offered by this very chapter? What is indicated to us that we can use right now to do that?
I wanted to stick in a really quick quote that I've shared before that's kind of a summary of what Silverdale was saying. Mayor Baba said, "The creation of love is conditioned and sustained by the tension of duality."
Yeah.
And I also wanted to say about how you educate it, my answer to that, given the book, would be very simple. Stay attentive and follow your sensations. And then as for the tension of duality, we can come back to the struggle of sorcerers.
Why is there more than one chapter in this book?
Because people think differently. And yeah, sure, go ahead.
David, can you answer that question you just asked? I'd be really interested.
Nice.
I'm very interested in how you would do that. Like I think it's a really valid question. I'm interested in how you would answer that.
Which particular question? The last one I asked, which is, why is there more than one chapter in the book?
No, the beginning, first, before that.
Okay.
I can't repeat it because I can't remember exactly that. But it was something to do with reality, with what, how do you make it real?
Of the tools, there's a particular, and I'll throw this open to you, Silverdale, as well. There's a particular type of energy that occurs in the process of yearning.
Yeah.
In the yearning that occurs, it is not a reactive emotion at that time. If I can literally separate from the guilt and see the different vista in front of me, I experience a form of yearning at that time. And to stay in mode is part of how I am interpreting this chapter. I understand what you're saying about the matrix behind it. Now I'm asking, then how do we therefore create an exercise that I can say I am working right here, right now with remorse of conscience?
And how does it connect to yearning? Like if I yearn for something as a child, if I yearn for something and I didn't get it, I create a coping mechanism that says, I don't need it.
You're talking about the yearning of the machine or the yearning of the mechanical self in the same way that one would have guilt. So that kind of yearning is like guilt. The kind of yearning that David is talking about is more like remorse of conscience, where it creates possibility through attention and through expansion. And that kind of yearning, in a sense, is like if gratitude is the fullness and the plenitude feeling, then yearning is the emptiness, but they're both a kind of a longing to interface with the creation in a more intimate way than we've been able to up to that point.
So I guess part of the interesting element, and I'm intimidated to bring this out in the face of your commentary, but in the yearning, in the actual sense and remorses regarding my mother, I can distinguish between guilt and what I call a certain kind of a yearning, or the beginnings of it. And even so, even in a certain way of laying upon the matrix of our regular bloody life here as just maggots on this planet running around, spawned by mothers who then you go and you spawn more. Granted that that's the case of the mechanical life, but can I not use that and use the exact same elements and raise those elements to a different level? Now, I say that we may look at the same bloody mechanical world with one set of eyes, and then we look at it and we can see it in a different manner with a different set of eyes. It's like a different functioning within us, and when I do that, I'm exercising my being at that moment. And in exercising my being, I at that point am working directly and specifically in toward transformation. That is an exercise of transformation at that moment. I'm building my inner muscle by doing that.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers anything.
Well, it clears something up.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so Sama a little bit ago said, what tools do we have right now to work on this? And Townsend Girl just asked, does David mean looking at life through attention?
Looking at life through the non-phenomenal self. We are blessed with two sets of eyes. And one set of eyes is the historical personality, which is a great name for the mechanical human biological machine. And there is this spark of divinity, and the spark of divinity lives in a different place within us, but we may see exactly the same thing. And I am in a position through exercise, through trying it many times, where I can from time to time know that I'm looking with this second set of eyes. And the second set of eyes is the exercise in itself. And it's this effort at understanding in that manner is virtue itself. I don't know if, so how do I exercise that part? I stay in this remorse, this sense of yearning. And
so are you saying that remorse is connected to yearning?
Yeah.
Very much so. It's like I want to get home. Why didn't it? Almost to the part of the problem, we have to realize that for the most part, now, everybody here is a divine creature. And in a unique way, you are at a class on the phone. Diana's on the phone. It's 11 o'clock at night for her. And she's blasting away on this phone. That's pretty bloody unusual,
yeah.
Okay? This is not some Tony Robbins or whatever the guy's name is, I hope you feel better in the morning seminar. This is just bloody hard work that we're working together on it. Everybody here is a divine creature and a mechanical self, okay? When we understand the mechanicality of it, and we, by embracing the fact that we have a mechanicality of our machine here. We do not abandon at the same time the divine part of us. This is what Silverdale is telling us. We are made up of different parts, and they're fundamentally different. So, and in working to bring those together, to blend them somehow, at that point, we start to create being. And as that second part grows, we can actually do have more compassion for the mechanical self. And there's a certain kind of freedom that occurs at that time. And as the last paragraph on that one, page 24 says, we actually do act differently to our fellow humans because we have found a different space of clarity within ourselves. By clarity, I don't mean that we can think better, by the way.
Okay, we're getting right close to the hour. I also would like to come back in on what Leona was talking about. Do we want to do a tape change here?
A tape change?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead and do a tape change now.